You're listening to Zen Crossing, where spirituality meets everyday life, with your host, Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center.
Today we'll be talking about seeing clearly. Our guest is Brian Lesage. Brian has practiced Buddhist meditation since 1988 and has taught meditation since 2000. He has studied in the Zen, Theravadan, and Tibetan schools of Buddhism. He was ordained in the Rinzai Zen tradition in 1996. His training in Vipassana meditation includes doing extended meditation retreats in Myanmar, Nepal, and India, as well as numerous retreats in the U.S. He leads retreats and teaches meditation courses nationwide. Brian also has a private practice of somatic experience, which is a naturalistic approach to healing trauma. You can visit his website for somatic experiencing at www.liberatingawareness.com. I was at that Rinzai Zen ordination way back in 1996, and Brian and I trained together at Mount Baldy Zen Center for some years, where I enjoyed his company, even though he beat me all the time at Go. It's an odd and special thing to train and to live together for a time like that, and even though we've been out of touch for a little while here, I know I'll always feel a particular bond with Brian. Brian, thanks for taking the time.
My pleasure.
Brian, can you talk a little bit about what clear seeing means to you and how you came to recognize, to realize its importance in your practice?
Yeah, so this term clear seeing, what it means to me is just to bring it back to the early Buddhist tradition. It's a translation of this word vipassana. Vipassana comes from this verb pasati, to see, and then the v is a prefix that could be seen as seeing clearly. And I think a way of understanding it is it's, for me at least, maybe just for this conversation, it's a sense of being able to see how this mind works, and through seeing how this mind works, there's a kind of freedom that comes with that. And I find it's really important for my practice and my life. And I was thinking maybe I could just give an example of this, just a simple
Sure.
example. So one day, I was here in Flagstaff. I live in Flagstaff, Arizona. And I was walking down the street, and it was during election time. And I walked by this house that had a political sign up, but it was a political sign of someone who I was not going to be voting for. And it was so interesting to see what happened around the sign. So I see the sign, and then all of a sudden, I felt like I knew the people in that house. Hmm. Like, I knew that they weren't very good people, which was totally crazy, right? Like, I have no idea if there was who those people were, or I didn't even know if there were people living in that house. But my mind had added on to that experience in that way that was actually crazy. Hmm. And I think with practice, I can see more clearly, seeing clearly, how my mind can take this kind of this sense data that comes into the mind, and then it can make stories that can be really actually so harmful to others and myself.
Hmm. Seeing through the stories that you tell yourself?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, as you said, it goes back to early Buddhism, this idea of seeing clearly. And I've heard you say that the Buddha likely thought about practice in the context of the society in which he lived in India. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, it was just something that struck me as I entered into kind of studying more and practicing in Theravada Buddhism and early Buddhism. I was reading a lot of these discourses. So there's a whole collection of discourses in the Pali language, Pali being the early scriptural language of Buddhism. And it was interesting to see the Buddha taking issue with aspects of the society that he found around him, in particular, the kind of the Brahminical tradition around him. And what was so poignant, and I think in the aspect of the Brahminical tradition that you see the Buddha questioning, is this idea that the Brahmins were somehow superior to everyone else that was in society. And, you know, maybe just to back up a little a bit, you know, during the Buddha's time, this, the kind of the Brahminical societal system divided people kind of into four classes. So it's kind of the precursor of the caste system that we know, that we sometimes see in modern India.
Mm-hmm.
And the Brahmins were superior and the others were inferior. And the Brahmins would contend they were superior because they were, because of the family that they were born into. For example, there's one discourse, and this Brahmin saying to the Buddha, you know, we have this idea, you know, the Brahmins are born from the mouth of God, from the mouth of God, of Brahma. That's actually what makes us superior. And the Buddha says something like, yeah, no, dude, you got it wrong. You know, I've actually seen born Brahmins born from a mother's womb. They're just like everyone else.
Hmm.
And so you find pieces of this in the discourses where the Buddha is contending. He's really questioning this system. And even the monastic system is calling that into question. If you think of the monastic system during the Buddha's time, it was, the hierarchy was dependent upon, which is, I think it was in the Zen tradition too, of when you were ordained. So that means if someone from a lower class got ordained before a Brahmin, that Brahmin was going to have to be bowing down to that person from a lower class. So it was really creating a, you could say at least a alternative society that was really bringing that into question. And I think it was about some of the oppression that came around it. There's other discourses that I won't go into right now, but it's interesting of him pointing out how oppressive it is to have this class system, these around these with the Brahmins being superior merely because of the family they were born into. And so it makes me wonder, and I think it's really there that this questioning and this looking at these societal dynamics is part of our practice.
Hmm. So do you think the Buddha was calling his followers to see through certain societal prejudices that existed at the time? Is that what you're...
That's my feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, it was done in a different way. It was such a different cultural context. But given discourses like that and how, you know, another example is he really tried to use this word Brahmin differently. He tried to redefine it, of a Brahmin being one who is awake in a Buddhist sense, one who is ethical in a Buddhist sense, rather than one who is born into a Brahmin family. So there's a contending with that, and also sometimes questioning the oppression that comes from Brahmins hiring people in the lower class, and how those people in their lower class were poorer off, not as well off as a result of that.
But the Buddha wasn't just saying you should see people this way, was he? He wasn't just saying, let me tell you the way to see different sorts of people. He had a practice that he was suggesting that people do in order to clear up their vision in a certain way, right?
Yeah, completely. Yeah, I think it's a great statement, Goshen. And actually, the practice that comes to mind, and it's a practice that is so confusing, and it's one that confused me at first, is this practice of sense restraint.
Mm.
And, you know, sense restraint is something that's talked about in Theravada Buddhism, and you find it, again, in these Pali discourses. And it can sound like when I first heard it, I was thinking, this is kind of weird. Like, I have to walk around not seeing things and hearing things.
Hmm.
But the Buddha was really clear that that's not what he was talking about. He was talking more about, actually, he was kind of talking about what happened when I saw that political sign in Flagstaff, of really kind of parsing apart what happens, let's say, in the activity of seeing. And now this could be around the activity of hearing or something like that, but it's like seeing. So let me just briefly go over it. It's like I see there's the scene of a form. Let's take the Flagstaff sign.
Hmm.
I see it. There's the scene, and then there's the words, and there's the interpretation, and then what comes with that is what he calls themes and details.
Hmm.
So a theme would be like, just to make it simple for this conversation, like the story I was making about those people in that house. I was creating that story. And when I grasp onto that, suffering arises. And so guarding the sense doors is just being with the activity of seeing, but not getting lost in these kind of secondary things that the mind does, like these signs that come up. You could say, to make it simple, these stories that come up.
Okay, but don't we need stories, Brian? Don't we need stories and themes in order to make sense of our lives?
We sure do. There's a place for stories, but it's how I hold them. Like another one, I think this might be useful. Like when I walk around the street, I might see people, and what comes immediately in my mind at times is the story of man or woman. And those can be helpful at times, but also not everybody fits into those that binary category. And it doesn't mean I stop using man or woman. It's just that I hold it lightly in the space of not knowing, actually. So it's you could say it's holding the conceptual world lightly, not throwing it away, but not getting entangled in it.
Yeah, that resonates a lot with my experience as well. You teach a lot of retreats, and I know you're going to Insight Meditation Society soon. And that's a different environment than at home, needless to say, and also a different environment than a short day sit or something. And I've heard you talk about how a Buddhist retreat isn't about participants retreating as individuals as much, and going through their own process, but it's more about being a body among other bodies in a community. Can you talk a little bit about retreats and how they fit in with seeing clearly?
Yeah, so from this perspective, you know, sometimes I like to use this phrase, you know, being a body among other bodies, so that when I'm on retreat or other people are on retreat, I have a sense of being mindful, but I'm also being mindful of how this mind can create these signs around other bodies. Just as, because our minds do this so often, depending upon what's interpreted. So it could be around skin color. It could be around how someone appears to be old or young, or how someone appears to have a large body or a skinny body, or an abled body, or a body that's not so abled, that doesn't have as much ability from that perspective. And the reason why I find it such a wonderful thing to be aware of is that in some ways I get to see play out the conditioning that's happened in this mind from society. Like as Krishnamurti says, this mind is society. It has been shaped by that. And when I can see that clearly, then I can step out of a lot of, I think, sometimes the oppressive dynamics that happen, for example, around age. You know, people that are older, and they've done so many studies, older people a lot of times have a negative bias towards them. And we know this around skin color, too. There's so many examples around skin color, around gender. Women still make less money in the same jobs as men. And so when I get to see that, I can start to step out of that dynamic by not being as hooked by it. And to think that, you know, I have a mind that's not affected by that would be crazy, because this mind grew up in this society.
Sure.
So I think there's something really freeing, not only individually, but in terms of our society. And this is a way of kind of bringing in the interpersonal dynamic, even on retreat.
Does that last after retreat for you, Brian?
If my practice keeps up. I think there's a couple things that allow it to continue. One is a regular sitting practice. And then also what's so talked about so much in Theravada Buddhism and early Buddhism is spiritual friendship. If I'm having these conversations with people again and again and again, and having support through friendship and community, I feel like it's really changed my relationship to basically what I'm talking about is implicit bias. And I think all of those factors together allow for something different to unfold, at least in this mind.
So what you're saying is you're glad I called.
Yeah.
I just want to second that, too. I really feel that there's nothing like a community to keep the various things that you've learned in a deeper, you know, retreat practice alive. Well, what's next for you in your practice of learning to see more clearly?
That's a good question. Just given what we're talking about now, what's kind of alive for me is not only my sitting practice, but also this question of what it is to cultivate community. It's not like, I mean, it's the growing edge for me. I have so much to learn around what it is to create healthy community and something I'm excited about. That's what's next for me is putting more into that. Yeah.
Well, I hope to see you up at this community one of these days, Brian.
I do, too. It'd be great to come up and visit you there.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Talk to you later. Thanks for listening to this episode of Zen Crossing. For more information about the Puget Sound Zen Center, go to pszc.org.